The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Gracious God, in holy baptism, you have called us to yourself. We have been drowned and raised to life in you. We ask you, O God, to give us courage and wisdom and a heart to turn to you, that we may see you in us and in everyone we meet. And we ask this in your precious name. Here's what I want to do this week. I want to explore these things, these texts which are baptismal texts, which are just so, it seems to me, so central to our life. What does it mean that I have been crucified with Christ? It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. How can that be true when I know that I'm so much so often in charge of my life? I mean, what does that mean? How do we get at that? And then St. Paul says in Colossians, for you have died, and your life is hid with Christ in God. And how is that? And what does that mean? And I don't mean theologically, yes, but in our lives, what does it mean that this is true? And so let me get at this by, let me start by saying that my exploration of all of this began, it got more clear. A buddy of mine was asked to write a book on spirituality for pastors. And he happened not to be a pastor, he's a youth pastor, but a youth ministry guy. So he said, well, I know a pastor, and he called me. And he said, would you like to help write this book? And I said, oh, that sounds really interesting. I'd like to do that. And we talked, and we got together a couple times, and we were going to write a book called, I forget what the title was, but we had three sections. And we both agreed that this was going to be good. It was The Dying World, Dying Church, The Dying Pastor. Because it felt like that was really what was going on. And especially among pastors, this guy, he travels across the country, and he kept telling me, Paul, pastors are miserable. They are just miserable. They're dropping out of the ministry. The ones who are in it are just totally miserable. And I kept saying, how can that possibly be? I love what I do. What are you talking about? And he said, you got to trust me. And I said, I don't trust you. I don't trust you on this one. So, but what I started doing was asking, down in Chelan, people come for vacations, and there's bishops, and there's assistants to bishops, and, you know, they come through, and I started asking them. And then my friend says that pastors are miserable. What is your experience? And every one of them said, your friend is absolutely right. This is where I spend most of my time, with pastors who are miserable. And I was like, oh man, that's... So I started thinking, what would make a pastor miserable? And then I said, what makes me miserable? And it boiled down to this. What makes me miserable are when I do things when I'm trying to protect myself, rather than trying to simply be aware and open and loving with people. And so that made me write a book, which is called In Defense of the Pastor and Other Tales of Disaster. and in this book, what happened was I just started collecting the times when I was miserable. And I looked at the theme, and that was the theme. When I'm trying to defend myself, when I'm trying to protect an image of myself, this is when I'm miserable. Are you asking?
I just want to say it's available in the bookstore.
Oh, boy. Oh, thank you. An unsolicited plug. So what I started to do was to go back and look at times when I really was miserable. A couple of times where I felt like I need to get out of this ministry because I suck at it, or because I just ruined it, or whatever. And inevitably, what was happening was I was trying to protect myself. Or trying to put out an image of myself that I thought was important and good of who I was. And so I thought, aha, I wonder if pastors don't recognize that that's what they're doing. And that's what makes them miserable. And so that's why I put this collection of stories together, and I was thinking, I hope pastors would read this and go, oh, yeah, I was in that situation. Oh, no, he didn't do that. He's not. Oh, no. Oh, he did. Oh, geez. But be able to then, you know, feel that and for themselves, and to be able to kind of recognize that, recognize actually vanity. Because I think it boils down to that. We all know what vanity is, right? We all want to appear good and look better than we are. But Cassian, who was an early church father, said, vanity is blindness to God due to a fascination with ourselves. And I think that's just a really nice, concise definition of vanity. So, that's kind of how I got in on all of this. And so, I think it's really important to start the whole thing is about this week is about living and dying, dying and living, I should say. And Luther said that our baptismal life is a daily dying and rising. Okay, and so how is it that we can do this daily? A daily dying to ourselves and rising in Christ. Okay, so we're going to get at that. What I propose that we do is to first of all let's first of all talk about these things. I mean, how can we talk about these things? Anybody got anybody that's been through Navigators or Campus Crusade or Young Life has memorized this text, right? I mean, anybody here been through those? None of y'all have been through those? Come on, this is like a major memorization text. But anyway, how do you all think about these things when you read these? What are you thinking about?
You know, I'll go ahead and be bold.
Please.
When I read that, I find it confusing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's lots of things in the Bible that I find confusing. that be one of them.
We
what exactly does that mean?
Yes. Exactly. What does that mean?
Well, what does that mean?
It's yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So my experience with that verse, or where I think I've experienced that, is there've been times in ministry where I've tried to do it on my own, to control it, to make it work, and everything's failing. Not going the way, everything's hard, it's just total frustration, and you finally get to the point where you say, okay, God, I give up, you're in control, do it your way. And then every time it's been easy and fantastic, mm-hmm. and you just kind of sit back and ride the wave almost, yeah. And so yeah. It's like when you get out of the way and allow God to work through you, and it's not you in control or your how you envision it,
uh-huh.
then it works.
Right. And part of that, of course, getting out of the way means getting the ego out of the way,
yep.
getting all of these
yeah.
things.
It, right. it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
Whatever happens, happens.
Uh-huh.
And it's usually fantastic.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I think that's part of what St. Paul's got in mind here. Absolutely. So does that make sense to you? Okay. Yeah, you're still, yeah.
Well, there's a lot there.
Yeah, there is. Okay. Yeah, anybody else have anything they want to say about these things? Yeah. Well, go ahead. You first.
To me, it's not, I'm not sure if I would take that word for that, but mm-hmm. it's the spirit of it, I understand, kind of, and I don't know, like, just day-to-day work. I often find myself feeling like, I need to do everything that's in front of me, where in reality there are people working alongside. sure if I want the, sometimes they want the glory of having done it all myself or control. I'm not sure which one. But yeah, it's hard. It's just hard to think of sharing it for someone else, so that someone else have, you know, have control of the situation.
Right. Yeah, you'd like to have the glory of doing it yourself. That's a glory is a great word, because vanity in the ancient world, like vainglory, is another word for this. Right. And so yeah, we want that for ourselves. Yeah. And we want other people to see that for ourselves, and to see that we are in control, that we can do it. Yeah. And did you have?
Yeah, I find it kind of freeing, and there's a peacefulness to it. Once you understand that it's not about yourself,
uh-huh.
It's about helping and serving others, at least that's what it means to me. And in helping and serving others, I oftentimes wind up helping myself in the end. If I have a problem that I need to work through, if I can turn it away from that problem and focusing on that and focus on something else and helping someone else, I often find that I'm able to work out that thing that I had going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what that means for me.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the paradox is you let go of this self, and then there's something else that rises up that is really authentically yourself. And that's, right? Yeah, an authentic way. Yeah, good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I guess what I think about is, it echoes my things people say, maybe a little darker, that when I'm at the end, there's nothing left. And that's what I see is Christ, the hope, the way through. But I seem to find plenty of ways, even with good intentions, to try, but kind of bang my head against the wall in some sort of ways. And when I'm totally wiped out, that's the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that sense, there's got to be that sense of surrender to the reality.
Okay.
Yeah. If in that sense, at the end, when you're banging your head against the wall, well, if I ain't been crucified, it's coming up shortly. Because yeah, right.
Yeah.
Because I got nothing left.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. Okay. There's a bunch of there's a lot in all in these things, and this is just very rich at the heart of the faith. What I think, what I do is I tend to have these, and this, I tend to have images of myself, like, right? I'm the pastor that ministers to people on the margins, okay, in my little town. That's what I, and I do that. That's not, I didn't create that. I didn't make that up. I do that. But there are times when, my favorite example is there's a bar called Senior Frogs down in Chilean. Some of you probably visited it. But in the morning in Chilean, during the week, in the early morning, there's a group there, and they already start drinking around 7 in the morning. But these are all the regulars. These are the Chileanites, you know, old-time folks. Vietnam veterans, different people like that who are there every day. And so I had a habit of going down there and hanging out with them, which was really cool. This is a great thing. It's really fun, get to know them and do ministry that way. So, however, if I haven't done that in a while, not only is it a great thing, but I know, like, my congregation really likes that about me. They like that I do that. So, if I haven't done it in a while, I start thinking, what are they going to think of me? I haven't done that in a while. Maybe I'm not so as much on the margins as I thought I was. And what do I do then? I go visit Seymour Frogs. Not because I love those people and I really want to be with them, but because I want to uphold this image of myself, right? As the person who ministers to people on the margins. That's craziness. It's pure vanity. But it's what happens.
I think we all do that.
I do too.
What does a good mom do? You know?
Uh-huh. Okay.
You drive the soccer carpool, you show up for all the PTA meetings, you are the first to put your hand up for a field trip.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to be a good mom. But sometimes that becomes a burden and you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
Ah, thank you. Great lead-in. So that's what I want you all to think about. Where does that happen with you? What kind of images do you have of yourself that you want to project and that you protect and that you'll do stupid, crazy things in order to maintain? So I want you to just take a minute and think about it. Let me ask you a question. Are you all feeling okay in talking in a large group like this, or should we break it up into groups to talk about this?
Stay one.
Stay together? Mm-hmm. Everybody okay with that? I don't see anybody nodding their head no. You're okay? Okay. Okay. All right. So let's take a minute and just think about it.
Yeah. I'd like to ask a question. If we do things for the wrong reasons, mm-hmm. and I have no argument against that, but we all do, certainly I do, have we painted ourselves into a corner that is it ever possible to do anything for the right reasons?
Have you painted us into a corner? I don't see that. My experience is there are times of authenticity that simply happen that are not me protecting myself or me protecting my image, that are just, that's just flat out ministry that happens. So I don't think that there's ever I don't think that we're stuck always saying, oh, we're never going to get anything right.
But you wouldn't say that that is an occasion where you are justifying your ministry and justifying your actions.
Correct. I would not say that. Yeah. I'm just talking about how my experience of it is absolutely that. There's a bit of a spectrum, but there are absolutely times when I know what I'm doing this totally aware that it has nothing to do with me. And it's really it's great. And there are times when I know this is absolutely about me. And it's horrible. And there's places in between. But I don't think that that we have to be constantly checking our pulse of what's my justification for doing this, or what's my reason for doing this? Am I justifying myself? Am I not? I don't feel like we need to get into that very paralyzing thing. Does that answer your question?
And good things do happen when we're doing it for the wrong reason. It's not that whatever we did for the wrong reason ends up being trash. It just is not mm-hmm. right for us. It might have worked out really well for somebody else.
Right. No, I heard a sermon yesterday about that. God can redeem anything that we do. One, good or bad. But,
Yeah, so it's not about if a good thing happened for somebody else or not.
Right.
We're talking about the other end of it.
Yeah, exactly. And we're doing that because it really, yes, the not, yes, I agree with you. But I want to invite us back to our own images of ourselves. So has anybody come up with something that they would like to share?
I was walking and talking with Becky today, which was a fantastic walk and talk. But the, it was very hot, and there were lots of bugs. But that's an aside. When there was a time in my life when I had foster kids, and I loved having the foster kids, and one of the things it did for me was it shifted my focus from me being a good mom for myself, for my own reasons, to I just wanted to give them a gift of the period of time that they were with me to shine a light that they could hold on to. And it took the focus away from what I was doing for myself, for my image and all the rest of it. But I felt like I was really, really present to being a good mother for all the right reasons at the time. Like I had real clear goals in mind, and I ended up being a better mother to my own children when I had foster kids at times. And that was really, it was one of those kind of convoluted ways of blessing that I really felt like having them there and being able to be serving them in that way was a huge blessing to me. I had more peace despite the chaos. I was telling her at one point I had their 3-year-old, their 4-year-old, their 5-year-old, their 6-year-old. And my 7-year-old. I'll tell you what, it was chaos. They were all girls. But it was one of the most, and I do use this word not lightly, blessed times in our lives, despite the chaos. I saw God daily in prayers that weren't even prayed being answered and things like that. And it was an amazing time. You know, conversely, then you have to look at the other times when, you know, when somebody called me and had an expectation that I was going to go on this field trip. And the kids came home and they're like, here, sign the paper, because you know you want to go to Seattle with 47 seventh graders, you know? And then I would be, that my heart wasn't in it. So I think it has to do with my perception of, you know, when it was given freely for the right reasons and when I was feeling put upon, and I don't even know how else to say it. But it felt very different to me. The net result is I'd still go to Seattle with 47 seventh graders. One of them would get lost in the Pike Place Market and have a miserable day. And Amtrak would refuse to serve Bellingham Public Schools after that particular trip. But, you know, it was, you know, I still went and did the things I needed to do. But it just, it completely different heart.
Right. Yeah. So one story in each direction.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have an image of myself that I am well liked and have a lot of friends, and
that's not true.
I'm sorry. I just and,
there would be times in seminary where I'd go to parties or go to a dinner group or whatever, like exhausted and not wanting to go at all. But in my head it was, well, if I don't go, then will I get invited to the next one? If I don't get invited to the next one, will I have, you know, will people think that I'm this social butterfly that I am? You know, so it was, the image that I was trying to protect was, I have friends, let it be known, I have friends. I hate being with them, but... no, that's mine.
Yeah. And the truth is, you are well-liked, and you do have friends. But you just had to prove it.
Yeah.
Is that
but I would frame myself unnecessarily trying to prove it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I did have friends. Everything was great, but in those moments of doubt, it was push it farther, you know, I don't know, just, and it wore me out. A gift that had been given to me, friends, became something that wore me out.
That's very key. Living this way is very tiring. And I think we are so unaware of it, but it's just, it's like walking around with a big old backpack full of rocks all the time. And it's almost like that's the natural way to do it.
And I think we, then we can also tell ourselves, well, we must be doing God's work if we're this miserable.
Yeah.
Somehow I think we get that kind of convoluted in our heads too.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you guys
I think one of the things that's so difficult to sort out for me with this whole thing, and I keep focusing on that word kid, But one of the things that I find so difficult to sort out is when, in fact, what each one of us have been given as gifts, as characteristics, as things that seem to be part of us, whether it's our social being, our mothering, or those things, when, in fact, it is us being hidden with Christ versus the opposite, where you're talking about ego. Because, and I don't know, I'm not explaining this very well, but if you have the gift of being very social, mm-hmm. or I know that one of the things that I expect of myself is to be organized on top of it and I can handle it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of where my self-being is, my identity. Mm-hmm. Whether, you know, Becky's is I have to be the social person, I have to be in control, I have to, and so that puts me just not ready with this whole thing. But when is it just what I do and who I am versus my ego getting in the way? Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. Sure. I think to go back to what I said, I mean, all right, so I do this ministry and I do it, and there's often times I really like it. It's when I do it because of the image rather than because I am compelled to do it in love. That's the distinction. So if you are in a situation where I'm going to continue to be in control because that's who I am, not because it's got to be done because our neighbor needs help. That's, I think, when that's the distinction, right? So
it's not a clear line.
It's not a clear line, but it certainly can be. It's something to be explored and examined, I think. Yeah, definitely. Can it ever be possible for you to be somewhere and things are not in control?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you here now?
Yeah.
I'm here. So somebody taught me a saying that I remember many times when I find myself falling into that, uh-huh. where ministry or whatever no longer is fun, is don't should on yourself.
Yeah.
I should do this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like that's a flag.
Yeah.
That says, oh, wait a minute, what? You know, I'm no longer doing it because I want to. It's because I should do it.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah.
Anyway, one image that I remember growing up that I don't know that I particularly wanted to protect this, but it was one that everybody kind of pushed on me,
mm-hmm.
was I was the pastor's kid.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So there was all this, you know, expectations about how you're supposed to act, what you're supposed to do, and I remember just it driving me up a wall. Because whatever you said or did, it was like you would always hear this comment.
Must be the pastor's
kid. That's the pastor's
kid. Yeah. Yeah. I went for a prayer retreat a while back to spend time in prayer with some colleagues. I was still grieving the suicide of my best friend. My father-in-law had a life-threatening stroke. Our children were chronically sick, living in a musty house, and I thought a day of prayer would be good for me. We arrived at the retreat house where we spent time alternating between solitary prayer and community sharing. Eager as I was to try out the rhythm of the retreat, I found the time of solitude unbearable due to fear. What was I afraid of? For one thing, I was afraid of dying. My friend's death was so recent and so raw that I couldn't face it. Sitting alone, memories of my friend and thoughts of mortality raced through my mind. My heart pounded, trying to keep up. Instead of praying, I spent the time taking my pulse. 75, 80, 90 beats a minute. It was agony to sit alone for the agreed upon half hour, all the while thinking I was going to die before ever reuniting with the others. The moment I heard the chime signaling that we were to reunite, I was out of my chair and sprinting down the hallway to the commons area. I had not dropped dead after all. Just before turning the corner, however, I slowed down to a dignified stroll.
entering the presence of others as cool as could be. Arriving in the commons area, my relief at not dying immediately turned into shame over having been afraid in the first place. There was no way I was going to let my colleagues know what had happened in my time alone. I was supposed to be a pastor, and I was afraid of being alone with God. So I sat with the others, listening to them speak about their experience, how they had relaxed into the silence. Too embarrassed to share my fear, I now find myself eager to get away from my colleagues and my shame. Fear and solitude was better than shame before others, I reckoned. Once back in my room alone, however, I couldn't wait to be reunited. Bouncing from fear to shame all day, the retreat that I had hoped for became an insidious, embarrassing endurance contest. Afraid to be alone with God, ashamed to talk about that fear with anyone, I did the only logical thing. I swore off prayer retreats. So this incredible defense of yourself, you know, like, oh yeah, this guy pastor, and so I had to defend that with my colleagues. Wouldn't it have been great if I could have just said, oh, you guys, I'm dying here, you know, I'm really dying here. And that would have been an incredible opening for us all. If they were open to being with me in it, oh, now that would have been a retreat. But I was too busy defending myself, not letting anybody see my fear. And so, yeah, it was exhausting. It was terrible. So.
In answer to Michael's question about whether that backs you into a corner, I think your story at Senior Frogs is a good way of describing how you're feeling, and then boom, you think, oh yeah, I don't have to defend myself. And that's okay. Yeah.
Yep.
Art.
Oh, about art?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
The one whose name, I couldn't remember who the student is.
Yeah. Right.
Of how that realization can turn things 360.
Oh, you're right. You want to reread that? I'm sorry to be reading about this stuff, but is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So this is actually the epilogue of the book. It's been months now since the stories of this book were gathered. The process of writing has helped me better notice when my defenses go up. I remind myself that there is no need to defend anything. I laugh when I find myself falling back into my own old patterns. Good thing, too, because the instinct to defend myself is still really strong. Just the other day, our family was out to dinner. We were walking back to the car when out of the bookstore came Chuck. Chuck is a local character with poor health and a drinking problem. He and I have been friends for years. This night, though, when we encountered him, he was not himself. I said, Chuck, how's it going? Haven't seen you in a long time.
Yeah.
I said, well, how's it going?
Huh.
This wasn't like Chuck. I knew something wasn't right. He said, well, huh, I'm not very happy with you. Chuck, what's the matter? I said. I thought you were going to visit me in the hospital. Visit you in the hospital? Shit, Chuck, you called me from Wenatchee to tell me you were in the hospital there. That's when I told you I would visit you. Wenatchee's an hour away. Then you called the next day and you were in Moses Lake. That's 2.5 hours away. I didn't have time to schlep all the way from here to Moses Lake to see you, man. I've been slammed these last 3 weeks. Funerals, pastoral obligations, negotiations with the city for a new food bank. I just couldn't get there. Hell, you're not even a member of my congregation. Not even a member? Where did that come from? All I can say is that this response was in place and ready to go before Chuck had even finished talking. Scary how fast it happens and how shameful and how petty it can be. The good news this time is that I did not say any of this out loud.
Yay.
As quickly as it came, there also came a reminder. You are dead. Let it go. So I did let it go. A little. I did say that, didn't I? Yeah, huh. You didn't come. You're a man of God. You're supposed to give people hope and support. Yeah, but people need a little hope in their lives, you know? When you say you're going to visit somebody, you should do it. Yeah, but... since I've known you, I've always looked up to you, but I'm real disappointed you didn't come to see me.
Yeah, but, oh, let it all go. You're right, man. I said I was going to visit you, and I didn't do it. I'm really sorry, and I hope you can forgive me. At this, Chuck smiles and says, oh, I already forgot about it. Now get the hell out of here. Your family's waiting. And he gives me a little push. It feels like a nudge towards freedom. So it's like, defend, defend, and then bam. Oh, wait. No. Why? Why defend? And then free to confess, free to be present, and free to hear the gospel from someone else. I mean, that's, to me, that was gospel. I'm wondering if I just haven't articulated very well this whole business of our images. Or are we just reticent, or is it just too new for us to be talking much about it? Help me out here.
Right, I think for me, I'm a little confused in that when you began with crucified with Christ, and if you're doing something for your own ego, but even if you're doing it that way, that doesn't mean the good is negated. The good is still there. What you're doing is still good. Mm-hmm. But you need to re-examine yourself. But I would see that no matter why you were going to visit those people at Senior Frogs, whether it was for your own ego or not, they benefited from you going there.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I'm a little confused that are we doing that just for our own self or whatever? Because I do a lot of things just for my own gratification or whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
But the good is still there. I mean, what I've done is still good, and it's still been helpful and beneficial to the other person. But I see myself, and I would think others do, that you have to have some kind of recognition for what you've done. To me, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you should just be doing it without. But for me, that'd be I would find that depressing.
Okay.
So I might have misunderstood what... Because the good is still being done, even if you're doing it for yourself.
But it's not good for... It's not. If Paul is going to Senior Frogs because he feels an obligation to be the man of God that he's supposed to be, and that's the reason he's going, then it might be good for the other folks, but it's not good for Paul.
Right.
Right.
So we only talk about life-giving and life-draining.
Yes.
If it's draining your own being, it's different than if you do it out of love and out of the grace of God. And then
so that's I guess I'm trying to understand the purpose that you're talking about is for us to let go of that burden or whatever of wanting the recognition back. I don't know. I guess I'm confused, but maybe by the end of the week I won't be.
Thank you. Okay. I think maybe it would be good to talk about the times when I'm doing something for my own protection and it's really lousy for the other people as opposed to good for them. Because that's when it really gets horrible.
And what would be an example of that?
If he had said what he thought in that last story, it would be a bad...
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. That would have felt really good to have said that, but it would have been really bad. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, I got.
So I guess.
Yeah.
Like one example would be like, I mean, I as a preacher really take preaching seriously. Really want to be a good preacher. Really beat myself up if I think it's not a good sermon. And so yes. I push it, and that hopefully benefits everybody who listens to my sermons. It comes at the expense of my husband. Like, you know, and if I have kids, it will come at the expense of them, and it comes at the expense of my relationships with other people outside of my congregation. You know, like, if I'm, or in Paul's case, if you're going to Senior Frogs, you know, yeah, those people were good, but did he do that at the expense of time with his kids, or... time with other people in the church. You know what I mean? Like, it's good for the people that you just went for, but if you're constantly operating out of that mindset, you'll go to any extent to protect that image, even if it trashes the people that, you know, like spouses and family and stuff like that. Does that make sense?
But it will last a whole week.
Huh?
Would you agree?
Oh, yes, I would agree with that. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
I think something that's important here is the difference between... focusing on it not being good to do things for the wrong reason. That's not really the point.
Yeah.
The point is how freeing it is to be doing something without that image of self.
Yes.
Of saying, how I come across doesn't matter. What is important is that I let God work through me, and the freedom with that. We're talking more about shame and guilt and less about freedom.
Right.
Where I see it hurt or is that when you can no longer be your authentic self because you have to maintain this image, you can't, I'm the pastor, I'm whatever, so I can't let people see that I'm hurting or struggling or whatever. So I've got to, and so then you've separated yourself from community because nobody can. You've built a wall or a facade that protects you. You're protecting an image, and you're no longer, you can't ask for help.
Right.
To me, that's where I see that the trying to protect your image really hurts you. It essentially separates yourself from others.
Yes. Yeah. And.
And they know that you're not being authentic, so we don't like. We can't relate, or we're unwilling to share ourselves with someone who's not sharing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you become, you say, I'm hurting, I'm struggling, people want to help, and then they can share with you and open up to you.
Yes.
I'm sitting here, there's like a battle going on in my head. Because I can think of a lot of ideas, but then I feel like I'm standing on a cliff on either side because of my, I don't think we can get away from our vanity, and I don't think we can get away from our ego. I think we just are that. But at the same time, it's the whole simultaneously saint and sinner. You can't cross into one or the other fully. You're always both. And so I'm trying to come up with an example, but then I feel like, oh, but then I'm thinking that I'm, I get it, and there are stories where I definitely know it's all about vanity, and it does suck the life out of you. But as soon as I go down that slope and I say, well, how am I going to rectify that? Then it's me taking action to try and, not be vain, and I'm saying I just have to accept I'm vain, I'm ego, and you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
I have to accept it. I can't run away from it. It's going to be there. I can see that its effects, but I'm always on that line. I'm never able to, I'm not. But I also have to have hope that somewhere there's these little glimpses into God's presence on earth, heaven on earth. I have to have faith that those glimpses do happen, but I think the mirror never unfogs totally. We're always, as humans, living on that line.
Yes. Interestingly though, I mean, as you're saying that, it's very true, and the hope, at least Cassian, our friend Cassian, says that the only way through this business of vanity is to admit our vanity, and to admit how it affects us and the people around us. Okay, so
the awareness is first.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so to give thanks to God that we aren't perfect, and to say, oh hey, look at that. How about that? And to actually, he also says, what's the word he uses? Oh, to rejoice in being ordinary. Because in our minds, often, I think a lot of times our projections are like, we are just this extraordinary this, or we're doing that great thing, or whatever, you know? And he says, rejoice in being ordinary. That's one of the things about it. So we confess our vanity. What I think by that, I mean, like, let's tell our stories about that and the images that we hold and protect and defend. And that's the first step towards getting out of this whole trap of vanity, you know, of living into the freedom that this stuff is, I think these things are great scriptures of freedom, liberation. You know, if we can live into this, if we know, you know, God, I am defending myself again. I'm a corpse. Why am I defending a corpse? What? That doesn't make any sense. It is Christ in me that is alive. Not me, not my ego. So then there's a freedom to it. And I think that's where we're going for. So there is a real, I think part of my thing here might be that I'm, you know, I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time. And so I apologize if it hasn't been so clear. But I want to get at one thing, a place where my vanity was not a good deed at all. I mean, right? Okay, so let me see if I can. Well, there's a bunch of them. I'm trying to find
the
short
one. The guy that criticized your sermon?
No, I got. It's called The Eyes of Grace, and I'll just jump in here. Grace's older daughter, Laura, struggled mightily with drug addiction, living from place to place, chasing her habit. She ended up pregnant, and Grace committed to raising the child, little Joanna. Laura continued in her addiction, and another child was born to her. This child, however, was not going to be raised by her grandparents. She would be given up for adoption. Grace approached me about having the baby baptized before she would be given over to foster care and into the system. I suggested that since the child would be leaving very soon, it would be better not to baptize her into this community, but to let her be baptized into the faith community of her adoptive family. Of course, there was no guarantee that the adoptive parents would care to do so, but the promise that the congregation makes in baptism to faithfully bring the child to the service of God's house, etc., would not be possible if the child were not among us. That was my thinking. There may even be good reason for it, but even now I feel myself trying to justify my actions. The truth of the matter is that a grandmother who struggled mightily to do what was best for her granddaughter and her family came to the difficult and heart-wrenching decision to let go of this newborn child, and the one thing she most needed was the promise from God spoken and enacted over this child, and I wasn't seeing it. What was I thinking? I was thinking about how important the community is to baptism, how we have lost the sense of baptism into a community. I was thinking about being the protector of the integrity of the sacrament. In thinking thus, I failed to speak and enact the very promise of God which the sacrament embodies. It gets worse, I'm sad to say. Yet another child was born, a baby boy. Grandmother never approached me about baptizing that child. There was no discussion about baptizing the baby who was also headed for adoption. But the child never made it to adoption. He died in a car crash before he was 3 months old, unbaptized. I'll skip a little bit. I knew what I had to do. I went to visit Grace. The entire way there, I was trying to figure out what I was supposed to do when I arrived. How could I give comfort to this grieving woman when I knew I had been part of that grief? I found her with a friend, distractedly moving about the house from room to room. She greeted me. She kept up her flight. Chasing her about the house, I gave my condolences about the baby, but that did not seem to relieve my burden, which now I am ashamed to admit became my main focus. Grace did not bring up the fact that the child was not baptized, but in my guilt and self-justifying stupor, I had to. I had to tell her something, anything. So I told her that in the ancient church, for those who died before they were baptized, death itself was considered to be their baptism. There, I had taken my best shot at comforting Grace and relieving my guilt. With eyes on fire, she whipped around at me. And said, "You know, someday that might give me some comfort, but right now, frankly, I don't see how." Of course she couldn't see how. It was never intended to give her comfort. It was meant to give me comfort. It was meant to justify my position and to address the anxiety I felt for the terrible part I played in this sad drama. When her eyes shone on my cowardice, my face instantly grew hot with embarrassment, and all I wanted to do was get out from the searing light of her glare, out of her house, and out of ministry. So that's where it can drive us. You know, we have this image of ourselves as whatever it is, and we might even be doing good stuff, but then at some point it turns and we defend ourselves and justify ourselves. You know, that's good Luther language. You know, and we do that, but we do that to the detriment of others often. So no good works there. And I don't think that I'm alone in this. I think that this is what we do often. And I think that our Lutheran theology, and Paul's theology, gives us a way to deal with that. Gives us a way to look at it differently. And so that's what I'm proposing that we do. So, what I think I'd like to do maybe is, can I give you all some homework? Can you come back, can you go away, think about this, and actually just look at your own life? I mean, I don't want you to think theologically, I don't want to have, that's really interesting, but I don't think it really gets, I think, we have to go in and really think about our own stories. Times when we've really tried to justify ourselves and to defend ourselves. And maybe we can come back and share some of those. Take some time and on when come back and we'll talk about those things a little bit. And then we will go into the whole business of what it really means to die in Christ. What the cross and resurrection has to say to all this. Any comments? Concerns? Okay. Okay.